And welcome to Table Talk, Spectator Life's food and drink podcast.
We are delighted to be joined on Table Talk today by Ella Risbridger. Ella is a writer and poet whose first cookbook, Midnight Chicken, has recently been published by Bloomsbury. Part memoir, part cookery, Midnight Chicken explores mental health, friendship, love, and the redemptive power of food and cooking, all through the medium of recipes.
So Ella, welcome to Table Talk. Can you start by telling us a bit about your earliest memories of food?
My earliest memories of food. I know that I used to insist on having milk warmed in the microwave for 19 seconds, which sounds like the most disgusting thing imaginable. It's just like, just enough to take the chill off, not enough to be warm. Earliest memories of food.
Who was the cook in your household when you were younger?
So my mum very diligently did the cooking when she could. She worked a lot. And so when we were little, I had a nanny who... We had tuna pasta bake every day. We ate so much tuna pasta bake. It was delicious.
It hasn't put you off.
I think I had to have a lot of time away from it. But that was when both my parents were working full time. And sort of between constant thing of being between school and nursery and nannies and childminders. And I just mainly remember eating tuna pasta bake. And then once my younger sister was born, I'm the oldest of four, my mum gave up work. And then we had a lot of healthy things. You can hear the sort of dismay in my voice. I think my mum took it very seriously, cooking for us very seriously. And she took kind of the nutritional value and organic things very seriously. We're not allowed a lot of sweets, not allowed a lot of fizzy drink. It was very much, we lived on a kind of small holding at that point. So we had sheep and we ate them. We had grew vegetables and ate them. It was very... very idyllic, but not when you're eight and what you really want is Space Raiders.
And did you still have tuna pasta bake during that time or did that fade out?
Faded out once my mum had a bit more time. I mean, as much time as you ever have when you've got four children under seven. So we had lots of healthy things, lots of homemade bread that took all of playtime to eat. And the funny thing about this is my mum has really vivid memories of being eight and having to eat homemade bread and it taking all playtime to chew and resenting her parents. And I just know that my sister and I are going to grow up and if we have kids, there's going to be making homemade bread. And you're like, well, it's good for you.
It's good for you and you'll eat it.
Was it sort of an activity? So making the bread was part of the kind of way of keeping you guys all entertained for a few hours?
No, we used to make pizza. We used to make pizza on a Friday night with all the, what felt like at the time, all the kids in the village, but it can't have been. Although when you look at family photos, it's always like, and there's mum, there's dad, there's the four of us, and there's Bethany, who lived two doors down, and there's those boys. Does anyone remember who those boys were? No, they were there too.
But they came round for pizza.
People did. But my mum would make the dough. We had an Aga. It's one of those things that is so obvious if you look at me that I grew up with an Aga. I wish it wasn't. I am, in fact, on the cover of Aga Monthly.
Oh, wow.
I know. Oh, in March.
God.
I'm
You've
so
made
excited.
It.
It's the best thing that's ever happened.
You really have made
it's
it.
It's the only thing in all of the publicity for Midnight Chicken that anyone in my family has been truly impressed by.
Until now.
Until now,
until
obviously.
Now, of course.
I think my dad will be most impressed by this. My sisters were very big on Aga Monthly. Yes, we used to have the dough for the pizza on the back of the Aga. And then we would come home from school, take it off the back of the Aga where it had been roasting very slowly all day. And then just chopped tomatoes, grated cheese, chopped ham.
Perfect 90s pizza.
I do. Oh, Aga's good for making pizzas.
Pretty good, yeah, because you've got like the hot oven and you can leave the dough to rise very slowly, very organically and very nice. It's all... I mean, I remember the pizzas being horrible and just wishing we could go to Pizza Hut once ever. But no, we were never.
And now you'd rather have homemade pizza than Pizza Hut.
Well, this is how I feel about my mum's bread, you know? Like all the time as a child I spent being like, don't make me eat the bread that you have lovingly made with, you know, like...
How dare you?
..local flour. And you've done this very slowly with the sourdough rise and it's delicious. The amount of time I spent as a child wishing for sliced white. And now I go out of my way to find such expensive bread.
When I was little, I hated fish pie and my mum used to make it and I loathed it. And it was one of the first things that I then cooked for myself as a means of comfort. And it wasn't until halfway through making it that I realised, I don't like... fish pie. What's happened? And then I made it myself. And I was like, it's the most delicious thing in the world. What's wrong with me? Children are brats.
And I mean, is there anything that you still cook that your mother used to make apart from bread?
I mean, I cook a lot of things that I think my mum used to make because she made sort of, we were very much a children eat at 6:30. And then I think as my So we lived in Northamptonshire and my dad was working in London. So he wouldn't be home till like 8:30, 9:00 earliest. So we're very much like a kids' tea family and an adults' tea family. And it always used to surprise me when I'd go to people's houses and their parents would eat with them. Like, all right. All right, fancy. So my parents ate recipes out of recipe books.
Oh.
My parents would like have a curry. Or like, we had fish pie, spaghetti bolognese, occasionally lasagna, but not very much. Because faff, lasagna is the world's biggest faff.
Yeah. It's people underplay the faff of lasagna. It's serious faff.
It's minimum a 3-step process. Yeah. I suppose if you buy a sauce and then buy a jar, but then why not just buy a lasagna?
I'm with you. I mean, I often do. So did you learn any of the recipes from your parents?
Almost none of them. There's a cheese, there's a thing with goat's cheese and pastry that's in this book.
Yes.
That I learned
with
off my mum.
Parma ham?
Yes, my mum does not put parma ham in it.
Oh, really? That's an Ella introduction.
Yeah, my mum does it. Goat's cheese, puff pastry, folded up. Very simple. My mum likes things to get done. She really doesn't want to waste more time on food than she has to. She would be terrible on this podcast. She has no feelings about food. She did once become vegan except for fargua, which is an outstanding sentence. She just really likes it. She just likes that food. But otherwise, I think she'd be quite happy to take a pill that would give her her nutritional needs for the day.
And she produced you.
It's mad, isn't it? Absolutely mad.
So you went to school and you'd also lived in Dubai. Were you at school in Dubai?
Yes, so I was in Northamptonshire until my mid-teens and then my parents were in Dubai for a bit.
And has that influenced... I mean, what do you eat that? Has it influenced the way you cook or eat now?
It's made me very snobby about things like good biryani. Mm-hmm. And there's a thing called Lebanese cheese bread. Its proper name is manakish. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. I think it's pronouncing manakish. Can't get it. Can't get it in England. It doesn't taste right. You can't make it because it doesn't taste like it did when I was 15. I don't know how much of how it tasted was just that I was 16. I could go to the Lebanese bakery after school and then to the beach.
Mm, that does sound good.
So soft and pillowy. We used to get them from the school canteen. Mm. And they would come like folded around. They're like imagine a pita puffed up and hot, but inside is all pillowy bread.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And then a kind of white cheese that's kind of halfway between mozzarella and halloumi.
Inside or on top?
On top, and then the whole thing's folded in half.
Oh, wow.
We would buy them for, I think, like 8 dirham, which is a bit more than a pound. And you'd get them, and you'd open it up, you'd put salt and pepper in it, the little sachets, and then you'd put it in the microwave in the sixth form common room. Oh. And it was so soft and pillowy, and the cheese was so stringy. But also, how much of how delicious that was like having that freedom of being like, I don't have to have a packed lunch. I don't have to go to a canteen. I can eat a cheese bread, and I'm going to go to the tuck shop and get a chuppa chups. Tuck shop was in a corner of our common room, and it was run by, I think, prefect.
Right.
And it was just a big box of chuppa chups.
They
may have sold other sweets as well. I was focused on the
chuppa chups. You were blind to the other options.
Apple chuppa chups, cherry chuppa chups. I don't think I was ever without one. I wonder if I've got any teeth.
Have you tried to recreate this cheese bread? Is it something you've tried?
I have, but it's impossible. Not least because it's really hard to get the cheese here. It's like, I think the cheese is called Akawi cheese, but I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. And there is apparently a deli in Shepherd's Bush that sometimes has it, but not reliably, and I live a long way from Shepherd's Bush.
You can live much further from Shepherd's Bush, really.
It would be really hard for me to live, while still living in London, for me to live further from Shepherd's Bush. And am I going to go all the way to Shepherd's Bush on the off chance that a deli might have some cheese so then I can try and fail?
Yes, to discover that it's not as good as it was when you were 16.
Pillowy. Yeah. And also, how much cheese do I wish to consume now? Do I wish to consume the same amount of cheese as I ate when I was 15, which was all the cheese in the world? Just cheese bread after cheese bread.
Mm. With the odd chubba chop in between.
My chubba chop in between.
A palate cleanser.
That sounds good. So you then worked as a nanny in France. Was that after Dubai?
So I went from Dubai to France, where I had sort of mad, baffling experience in the south of France, which I've still not got my head around, but essentially I climbed over a fence and ran away. And I ended up in Paris with my best friend, who was an au pair, who had told her family, my best friend is having a terrible time in a chateau in the south of France. Which sounds really glamorous. It was not glamorous. It was the opposite of glamorous. It was just very horrible, and I barely got paid, and they would never tell me when my day off was, and I was very frightened all of the time. And so my best friend had told her host family, what would you want an au pair to do if she was unhappy and wanted to know if she was ever going to be paid? And God bless them, this family were just like, bring her here. Bring her here. We'll be able to find her a new placement, but at least she'll be out of there. She'll be safe in our house. And I got Paris. And the plan was that I'd find a new job. I'd been there for about 4 days when they just said, do you want to take over the cleaning of the house as well? And both of you stay.
Oh.
Will you do? So they had previously, I think, sent out shirts to be ironed and had a cleaner once a week.
Right.
And they said, if you're both happy to share this tool shed, which is what we were sleeping in at the time, if you're happy to share the tool shed, we like having you both. It's clear you both like being in the same place. Why don't you stay? So I did.
So were you responsible for any of the cooking there or just the cleaning?
We were responsible. So my best friend and I split it between us and we were responsible for feeding the three boys.
Right. How old were they?
3, 5, and 7.
And what did you feed them?
The tuna bake.
Tater tots.
I was going to ask, what's French nursery food? Obviously it's tater tots.
So it was the best thing in the world. I love this family. They're still... My mother will never get over how kind they were. My mother is still in touch with them.
Oh.
They see my parents not that infrequently. So for the main meals, it would be things from the freezer.
Right.
Fish fingers and tater tots, like occasionally a chicken Kiev thing. They were amazing. They came from, obviously it's France, they came from the local butcher and they were just...
Oh, the chicken Kievs came from the local butcher.
Very delicious. Nice. And also those ones that have got like cheese and ham.
Oh, chicken cordon bleu?
Cordon bleu.
Chicken cordon bleu. Yeah,
I've always found that name very funny.
Yeah, and it's like, there's no connection between cordon bleu, the institution, or in fact the magazine, and chicken cordon bleu. It's just a nice French name for it.
Occasionally we have chicken cordon bleu, and it was very good. But we would still have to do three courses.
Right.
So we would start. So it was 2 18-year-old girls, a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 3-year-old. And we would start with salad, and then... We would move on to the main course of tater tots, served properly with napkins and all of us sitting at the table. Yeah. And then always we would have either dessert or cheese. And it's like, after the fish, we've had fish fingers, tater tots and some vegetable. And I always remember the middle boy who was literally 5 years old, just shrugging his shoulders and being like, I guess I have a little bit of Comté if I must. This is the most French thing that has ever happened to me. As a 5-year-old shrugging at me and saying, if you must, I'll have...
Were they very well behaved? I mean, it sounds like they were...
No, they were nightmarish. I adored them. They were so much fun. But I think it was the year that French Children Don't Throw Food came out or had just come out. I just remember being like, these ones do.
They disproved the theory.
They didn't with their... They had very fancy Parisian grandparents whose flat I went to one time, and I think they were very well behaved there. I got the distinct impression that, you know, it was top buttons all the way. Mm. Top buttons done up all the way. But they were just... They were like every other child I have ever looked after or known, in that sometimes they were nice and sometimes they were appalling. But they weren't... I think I sort of expected French children to be innately better behaved. I don't think they were. I think they were the same.
So where was it that you then learned to cook? And what was... You've obviously written a cookery book. Where did that all come from?
Where did it come from? It came from... I moved to London. I moved to London because I fancied someone and his relationship had just broken up and I chanced my arm a bit. And I was going to university and I could choose where I went. And I... chose London on the basis that I fancied this man and I thought that if I was in London he would fall in love with me, and he did, so that was paid off.
I mean, it's serious good chancing of the arm there.
Liv, one day when we're not on a podcast I will tell you the mad lengths of being like, of asking him to take to asking him to ask me out, which is not... I did not play it cool
because it does sound quite cool that you just turned up in London hoping this guy would fall in love with you, and he did.
I mean, that's pretty much what happened, except that I had been madly in love with him for 2 years at this point, and I had just been waiting for both of us to be single at the same time.
And so it worked.
4 days. 4 days later.
4 days, wow. So where had you met him before?
He was at the boys' school next to the girls' school that my second cousin was at, and she had sent us both a message on Twitter, like, years before. You two will really get on. I think you two will be really good friends.
Little did she know.
She definitely knew. So that was nice. So in a way, it's a very traditional introduction. It's just that I was in Dubai and he was... I mean, we were both quite happy with other people. It was just a sort of... playing the waiting game.
So you waited and then you came to London.
I mean, then we moved in together on our third date, so it was fine. It was very nice.
And was he a very good cook?
He loved cooking. He was fantastic. He was a very good cook and a very interested cook and a very weird cook as well. He was really interested in reading cookbooks that weren't traditional. He was really interested in trying non-traditional ingredients. He was big into offal, for instance, and doing interesting things with offal. He basically veered all his life through mad decadence, spending loads of money on something incredible and mad diets. So the first time I met him, he was on a whiskey and apples diet, which is literally exactly what it sounds like. So food was a huge part of our lives together. But he was a very keen cook, and he couldn't believe, A, how little I cooked, and B, how unadventurous I was with food. So when I moved to London, I wouldn't eat chilli in anything. And one of the first things he made me was a pasta arrabbiata, and he had a mouth of iron. There was no amount of chilli that he couldn't take, and he put, for him, a fairly relaxed, it was probably like 4 teaspoons of chilli flakes or something like that. And I just remember sitting there thinking, I'm going to die. If I eat this, I will die. But if I don't eat this, he will at best be offended, and at worst think I don't fancy him.
Did you eat it?
Yes. Obviously I ate it. I had moved to London. I was very committed.
And a arrabbiata wasn't going to stop you.
I had moved from Dubai to London because I thought I needed to make it very clear I was not going to let the pasta get in the way. In hindsight, he might have already got the picture.
Yeah. From the moving there might have been some sign.
Some clue.
Yeah,
some inkling. And so did you then kind of learn to cook? Did he sort of teach you how to cook? And
he sort of taught me how to cook. And at the same time, I went a bit insane. That's not really that's probably not the best way to put it. I got this anxiety disorder, which the net result was I became very insane and very isolated, and not that I especially want to talk about it very much, but I tried to kill myself. And one thing that happens when you try and kill yourself is that they take you to hospital and you spend an awful lot of time in waiting rooms waiting for people to assess you. And if you try to kill yourself, you've not really thought this through, and you've not taken like a crossword puzzle or a Sudoku or a book. So you're in the waiting room. And I don't know how much time you spent in NHS waiting rooms, but it's horrible and there's nothing to do. They don't provide you with anything fun, particularly in a psychiatric one, presumably because, you know, you can't be trusted. So I was just there. What can I think about that isn't A, how miserable I am, B, how bored I am? And I just started talking to John, the tall man, my partner, about a pie. I just thought, this is what I would do if I was making a pie right now. And then smash cut through all the dull bits of hospitals and so on. We finally got home, just made a pie. And it was exactly the way I'd imagined it. And that was so satisfying. And I thought, this is a thing that I can do. This is a thing that, because when I was really anxious, it was hard to write and it was hard to work and it was hard to get anything done, hard to kind of create anything. As you know, no one really wants to talk about their creative process. But it'd always been very important to me. I'd always written. I have always written. And I couldn't do it when I was so anxious and sad. And I think cooking was a way to kind of, I don't know, harness that creativity in a way that had very strict rules and boundaries. And was, I think, is it Laurie Cotton? No, it's Nora Ephron. Like, if you put flour and butter together and you add milk, it will get thick. There are laws.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I found that very comforting in a way. And I think that was a huge part of it. And then, because I was so anxious, I didn't really want to go out anywhere. It's very, not, I wouldn't go so far as to say agoraphobic, but there would be weeks when I didn't leave the house, which I guess does amount to that. And if you stay in a lot, but you still want to have friends, you end up being like, come to mine and I will cook for you. Which does give you a weird, kind of gives you a really weird perspective on food. And it's something I'm still kind of trying to unlearn, is the idea that, well, I will trade you my food
for your love.
For your company. My friend said to me, we were coming back from Wales last week, and she said, you know, people would still love you if you never cooked for them. And I just was like, this is a terrible thing to say to me on a train. I can't leave. I can't leave. I can't escape you. I can't escape this terrifying statement you just said. So I guess, you know, I don't think it's possible to have a simple relationship, for anyone to have a really simple relationship with food. Maybe a handful of people, but most people have got, particularly most women, I think, have got sort of back and forth with it. Mm. And certainly part of my back and forth is being like, why am I cooking? What am I cooking for?
And what was the pie? I want to know, what did you cook?
I really don't remember. you write a memoir, and obviously you kind of, you're telling the story so much, and I've now read this chapter about me trying to kill myself hundreds of times, probably, in writing it and editing it, so much that it's become a kind of story.
Mm.
Like, do I actually remember that, or do I just remember remembering it now? Because I think with all traumatic things, either you remember it really vividly or you remember it not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly that's my experience of kind of very terrible things that have happened to or near me. And I now don't really remember trying to kill myself. I don't remember even why. It seems a very stupid thing to have tried to do.
One of the nicest things you talk about in the book is how important it is to try different aspects of cooking and to fail at them. And you talk about things that have gone wrong for you and how that's not necessarily a hurdle or something that's put you off. Tell us about something that's gone wrong for you and how you got past it.
Oh my God, so many things. Things that have gone wrong for me. So the thing I now do, anytime I'm cooking a meal for anyone or doing anything, I decide my menu, I decide everything I need to make, and I make sure that there's one thing in there that I plan to make and I buy the ingredients for that I am sure won't get done. So I was making things, I took a suitcase full of food to go away with last weekend. And one of the things I wanted to do was make a brown butter custard. Didn't do it. I separated the eggs, they're still in the fridge. They need to go in the bin. But I've decided that the secret to really good cooking is having one thing where you're like, it will go wrong. It will go wrong, or I will run out of time. Because then, and you don't tell anyone else what you're planning to make. They won't even notice. And that way, when something does go wrong, you've built in that contingency. It's a very wasteful scheme. It makes me feel so much better about my life.
Very
effective. Things that have gone wrong. There's a milk bread in my book, which I grilled for 45 minutes the first time I made it. It was black on the outside, like absolute, like coal black, and snowy, snowy white and almost raw in the middle. It just didn't occur to me that the oven was wrong. I just thought that that was what bread was going to do. The recipe for oat cakes in this book, I have tested a million times right up to copy edit day. They went wrong in every way a yeasted batter can possibly go wrong. There was one hideous time where they just rose. They just rose out of the bowl. Like, you make this pancake batter and then you leave it to get bubbles in the way you do with crumpets.
Yeah.
And I must have put too much yeast. It was fresh yeast, and I think I weighed it wrong. And I went away for 45 minutes, and I came back, and it had just, it had become alive. It had got so far out of the bowl that I thought it was sentient.
And now you keep it as a pet.
My loyal friend, I mean, my only friend.
How you get over kitchen disasters. You've just got a whole line.
Whole line of
sentient yeasted dose.
So that was quite bad. I was really terrified that someone would try and make it and have the same experience. I did change the recipe afterwards to one that worked for me, but yeah. I was still like, well, I mean, these recipes worked for someone else. This is my grandma's recipe I'm using.
And yeast is tricky.
Yeast is tricky. Yeah. Fortunately, a bunch of people have now made them and said they're fine.
These are Staffordshire oat cakes.
Yes, Staffordshire oat cakes.
As you say, the pancake star batter that you'd have with cheese inside, yes. Ideally. Not cheese, necessarily, but ideally.
Cheese and bacon, cheese and mushroom, cheese and sausage. All
that's so good.
Combination of all of those things.
It's one of the best ones I've got earmarked.
The best one is butter and marmite.
Of course. It's not the case with everything.
It's not strictly traditional.
But it's in the spirit.
In the spirit.
Talking of marmite, one of the recipes in your book is for marmite pasta, which you sort of reference back to, because obviously Nigella's also got a recipe. I mean, are there people like Nigella that you kind of, or other chefs that you've sort of looked to for guidance when you've been writing?
I assume everyone who's cooking does. I think it's almost impossible to write a truly original recipe. I don't know why you'd even try.
It's not the joy of recipes.
Because you have an idea, but fundamentally, most things have been done before and you're just tweaking.
Yeah.
Actually, it was one thing that was really tricky for me in the publication process was having to cut out essentially the lengthy provenance of each recipe. And trust
crediting.
Yeah. I would have 2 paragraphs. So I looked here and then I looked at this person and then I remembered a bit that I'd seen it before in a different book, but I couldn't remember what that book was. So I went to the library and then I found four more books.
Because it's weird that went in the editing process.
It felt important to me to acknowledge that there's this kind of family tree of recipes that evolve and move, and you take this and you tweak that. Because the thing that what I tend to do if I'm developing a recipe, it's the only time in my life when I'm even a bit organised, is I have a spreadsheet and have all the possible ingredients down one side. And every time I read a new recipe, it's got a different ingredient, and I'll put it down there. And all the sources along the top.
And then the amounts.
And then all the amounts. And then I, where I start is I average them all out and I make the average version and then I see what's wrong with it. So I'm very analytical about, for most of my baking recipes, I've got those spreadsheets of where everything came from. There's usually sort of 20, 25 recipes I average out. And obviously there are people I pay more attention to than others because they're people I trust. But especially if you're trying something that there aren't a lot of recipes for, particularly in kind of British cookbooks and cookbooks written in English, then you've really got to be like, well, there are 15 blogs, all very different. Let's work out a starting point. And I feel that it's really important to acknowledge that and to say all recipes are kind of handed down. They come with this story and this provenance. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm. Is there a recipe book that you, in your own cooking, when you're not recipe developing, you would return to more than others? Is there a sort of more thumbed than others?
So I don't really use recipe books. Mm-hmm. I sometimes do for baking, but I don't bake a lot. But I don't really use recipe books. However, Diana Henry, Change of Appetite.
Yeah.
Use it all the time. Cakes in there are amazing, which is not really probably the thing she wanted. No,
it's not. It's almost not the point of that book, but they are really good.
Change of Appetite, weirdly, I come back to a lot. Mm. I've done four things from Eat a Peach as well.
Ah, also Diana Henry.
Also Diana Henry, lately, and they've all been really good, but then Diana Henry's always really good.
Yes.
But the ones I come back to read, things like MFK Fisher, Laurie Colwyn.
Yeah.
Ruby Tando's Eat Up is a really good one to dip in and out of.
Yeah.
Blogs as well, like Smitten Kitchen.
So good.
So good and such a useful resource.
That's Deb Pillman, an American blog.
Yes.
Stratospherically successful.
Yes, new book came out here a couple of years ago.
Yes.
I want to say January 2017.
That sounds about right.
I mean, because I'm less of a cook than certainly than you, Olivia, but I mean, I loved reading your book because I just love reading food writing.
Thank you.
I mean, did you find the actual kind of writing process as sort of comforting as the cooking itself?
No, absolutely not. Writing is work for me in a way that cooking never is. It's one reason I don't and probably won't ever do anything like catering, or I've made one wedding cake ever and I'm never doing it again. But cooking is not work. Even when I'm recipe testing, it's not work. I get to count it as work and I'm really lucky, but it never feels like work. Even when I'm doing my spreadsheets, even when I'm doing sort of the worst thing in the world, which is saving your receipts so that you can work out what's tax deductible and what's not. It's never work. The actual cooking is never work. Whereas writing is always work for me. It feels always like serious, thoughtful work that I need to put effort and energy into. And I don't think I've had a day in my life where I haven't written something since I was 5 or 6. I'm always writing. I write probably 1,500 words a day, most of which never goes anywhere. And if I don't, I feel purposeless. Mm. So in a sense, writing the book was just a lot of careful, thoughtful work about what of these many words I'm always writing do I want to make public? In what way do I want to make them public? And the thing about writing a memoir is that you always have to be careful about who you're saying about what you're saying about whom, rather. Particularly one that, you know, it talks about my family and it talks about, so my biological father and I have a very complicated relationship, or have had historically, which obviously meant that I wanted to write in a certain way about my stepmother and my biological father's family. I don't see any of them anymore, but I still wanted to kind of acknowledge them and acknowledge that their loving presence in my life through the lens and kind of prism of this complicated relationship I have with my father, who's a very complicated man. And I knew that I was writing about that. And I knew that I was going to write about my sisters. I knew I was going to write about my friends. I knew I was going to write about John, the tall man. And although I write a lot of personal stuff publicly, I never do any of it without thought. I have to always be considering, who's going to read this? How is it going to impact them? Am I telling the truth as far as I can and as respectfully as I can? Because it's very easy to hide under a shield of, well, I was telling the truth. But you've always got to think about how your words are going to impact people and how people are going to take them. And actually, I was talking about this the other day, but the thing about writing recipes teaches you is that people are going to take what they want from what you've said. It doesn't actually matter what you've written down. Like, if you look at any internet food site, the comments are always, this worked great. I swapped the flour for sugar and I didn't use any eggs. But this lasagna was delicious.
Although better than when the comments say, this didn't work at all. I had to swap the flour for the sugar, but it still didn't work.
But like, people are going to read the recipes and they're going to get what they want out of it, right? And that's actually been very nice for me as someone who is this very, like, I try to be quite a careful writer, try to think quite hard about the impact of what I'm saying, not just on me or on the reader. It's hard to talk about the reader without sounding awful, but you know what I mean? Me or on the reader, but of my people, my friends, my family, the people whose stories kind of overlap and intersect with mine. But it's been very freeing to realise that mostly people are going to take what they want from what you've written, and you have no control over that.
And do you find that the sort of physical act of cooking, which is going to... It's going to arise in everyday life if you're a cook. You need to eat at certain points. Do you find that provides a counterpoint to the sort of thoughtful, careful writing work that you do?
I think so. I know if I don't cook, I become mad again.
Right.
So I guess it must be necessary from that perspective. I try and cook a main meal every day, pretty much every day. Very occasionally, my flatmate will do it if I am miserable. But I have to be really miserable to not cook, to not want to push through it and get it done, to do it myself.
Yeah.
But then I think, like most cooks, I appreciate being cooked for more than anybody else.
I was going to ask, what if you're not cooking, I mean, do you ever order takeaway? Do you go out, like, going to restaurants, that kind of eating? Is that...
Love takeaway. Love takeaway very much. Vietnamese takeaway is my favourite takeaway. You didn't ask that, but I'm going to tell you.
Well, you were going to. You've done well.
Vietnamese food is my favourite food of all. I think if I had to pick one, I'd pick Vietnamese food.
Do you cook Vietnamese food, or is it one you would get solely from others?
Oh, yeah. I go to the Vietnamese restaurant, get the Vietnamese takeaway. I made pho once. It was so delicious, and it took me 32 hours. I'm never doing it again. I did it in the slow cooker. I did it with proper bones. Mm-hmm. I did it really properly. But again, 32 hours.
Let's reiterate that, 32 hours.
32 hours. And it was really delicious. Was it as delicious as pho from a Vietnamese restaurant? No.
That'll arrive in 1 hour from delivery.
Did it cost me an awful lot of money to buy all the meat and the bones and the electricity? Yes, it did. There are just some things it's better not to cook at home. Like pizza.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, the best home pizza is never going to be as delicious as a pizza from a pizza place. Because you haven't, unless you've got a, what do you call them? Stone.
Oh, like the stone pizza ovens in your garden.
Unless you've got a big pizza oven that can get really, really hot, it's never going to be as nice as going to a pizza place where they've got a big pizza oven because you just can't get it hot enough. Some things are better in restaurants. Some things are better takeaway. Like dumplings.
Yeah.
I long to make dumplings.
Are we talking like dim sum style
dumplings
here?
Dim sum type dumplings. But I just, is it going to be as good as, so I've got a new dumpling place around the corner from my house. I mean, it's been there ages. It's just new to me. The dumplings are fine, but they are cheap and you can get so many of them. And I just think if I were trying to make these dumplings at home, it would cost me a fortune. It would take forever. And when I want dumplings within the hour.
Yes. Okay, so you're not making dumplings or pizza or 32-hour pho.
No.
What are you making? What's your sort of comfort food for a weekday evening when you've had a long day? So we're not talking like super special occasion, but what do you think is like nice to eat for supper?
There's a really good sausage pasta in my book. It's called Marital Harmony Sausage Pasta, and it's really delicious. And you cook the onions. It's really an onion pasta because you cook the onions for a really long time, but it's very delicious and very soothing. But again, it takes ages. What do we have for dinner? It's one of these things where I can never... It's when I try and plan a menu for a week and I'm like, well, we've never eaten anything that wasn't spinach and ricotta ravioli with pesto.
I think of you as a risotto maker. I don't know.
I am a big risotto maker.
Good, okay.
They tried to make me take it out of my book.
Do you know, when I spoke to Bloomsbury about your book, they recommended the emergency risotto to me and I thought, I know already. I know that Ella does good risotto, but that was the one they recommended. So
yeah.
You won.
So they tried to make me take out the line from my book. The one good thing, the best thing about me is that I can always make a risotto. And they tried to make me change it to one good thing about me. And I really wanted...
That's a very sweet...
It was very nice, but I really wanted to say to them, do you know how useful it is to be able to make a risotto from almost nothing?
Yeah. It is the ultimate store cupboard dish,
Lump of cheddar and some basmati rice? Can make a risotto. It takes some cobbling.
Yeah.
But you can do it. I've made a risotto very sad, made a risotto very happy, made a risotto so drunk I took the pan back to bed and burnt a hole in the duvet. It was perfect. It was 4 a.m. and it was basmati rice and cheddar and some peas. And I had to put some cream in because obviously basmati rice does not risotto.
No, it doesn't have the same breakdown.
Does if you put some cream in it. Stir it a lot.
And what about now? I mean, obviously your book is here in front of us. It looks beautiful. I mean, now that you've written it, I mean, has it inspired? I mean, what sort of next? I mean, are you going to keep developing recipes? Have you got lots more to learn, do you think?
So I'm doing a poetry anthology. So
this is with your other hat on. We said at the beginning that you are a writer and poet, but
I've got a lot of hats.
You do have a lot of
hats. Hat woman. Hat woman, they call
it. Hat woman can make risotto.
Hat woman. It's Tinder bio. I'd like to make it clear that I have no intention of going on Tinder. Just Phil, once you say Tinder,
I mean, it seems a shame not to with that kind of tagline, but
hat
okay.
Hat woman makes risotto. I've heard it's terrible, so I have no intention of doing it. So I have many hats. And one of them is that I used to write a poetry column for the now defunct website The Pool. And I love doing that. I focus mainly on women poets, modern poets, and poets that people might not have heard of and that might make people feel differently about poetry. Because I feel like people think they know what poetry is and they think it's school. And that's either Wordsworth or, do you remember, did you have the awful flimsy booklets that had Caroline Duffy, Simon Armitage, and the multicultural poets.
Yes.
Which, more you think about it, is
horrific.
The worst thing. Sorry, what you mean there is that the white poets can have a section each, and that all foreign poets
ever
get one section at the back. And they were taught so badly. I went to quite a nice school, and I quite liked English. But always, I've never met anyone who was taught poetry in a good way at school. We had one supply teacher once. Who talked about Seamus Heaney, and I was like, you get it, you know. But apart from that. So what I really wanted to do with this column was to make people like poetry. I wanted to call this book Poems for People Who Hate Poetry, but apparently that's not very marketing friendly. People don't buy books with hate in the title.
And it's not great SEO.
No, rubbish. So it's called Set Me on Fire, and it's coming out this autumn, and it's 102 poems that I think are great, and hopefully people will think some of them are great.
I think you have exceptional taste in poetry.
I do.
You do.
Risotto and poems.
And hats.
Good at both.
Yeah. No.
I'm really excited
for the poetry anthology.
I've got a hat now. I bought it for a murder mystery birthday party. It's got a veil and it's brown velvet.
Sounds like the kind of thing a poet should wear.
Do you know what? I did think about it today. I was putting on my new... This is my new coat. You can't see it.
It's very nice.
It's a podcast, but it is really great. I got it from a charity shop. It's so discounted and so fancy. But I was putting on my new coat and I thought, if I had gloves and my hat on, I would look like I was in the past. And there's a very appealing thought. I spent a lot of my childhood dressing as a Victorian.
It just doesn't surprise me at all.
No, my poor fashionable mother, who was buying these, you know, tiny Doc Martens and leggings and band t-shirts, and I would just insist on wearing a petticoat and a pinafore and a little mob cap thing.
Like you're ready for a themed day at school.
Oh God, they were the best days because finally
everyone
was dressed the way I thought we should all be dressed.
And just finally, I suppose we have to ask, if there's one recipe that you could pick in the book, I mean, is there one that's your favourite or that's most kind of meaningful?
So there's two. Midnight Chicken, which is the title recipe, because it was the first one I ever wrote a blog about. Also, it's the one I make most still. I make it once a week, at least. More if it's somebody's birthday.
It's a roasted chicken recipe.
It's a roast chicken. It's probably the best roast chicken in the world. I thought about being modest, but I'm not going to. It's probably the best roast chicken in the world. I love it so much. And other people do too, which is so pleasing and nice. And all you really need with it is like some bread and maybe some salad if you feel the need for health. So that. And cookies. You asked what we ate in France, and a thing we made a lot of was these cookies. We Googled chewy American cookies. And I think we just kept tweaking that recipe until it worked. We made so many. I don't know if you've ever lived in a house with three small boys, but in my memory, we made hundreds of cookies a week, which can't be true. But the cookie tin was always, we would fill it up and it would be empty by the end of the day, and then we'd make more. And I still make those a lot with tweaks now. I've started putting miso in them.
Ooh.
Which I know. My friend Cornelia, who was the one I lived with in Paris, they started doing it. And it's the best thing ever. Miso cookies. Who knew?
That sounds fantastic.
They are fantastic.
Ella, it's been such a delight having you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ella's book, Midnight Chicken, is available for order now. It's published by Bloomsbury, and it has a recommended retail price of £22. Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website.